Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, I'm Debbie, and I'm an alcoholic. Firstly, Harun, I am 6 weeks in the program, 6 weeks earlier than you. Yeah. I know, and you know that. It's something I really wanted to share. It's very important to me. It's actually the main reason I will not pick up a drink before he does. It's quite scary having a microphone. It's just come to me because when I was drinking, people would give me the microphone and I'd be on the table dancing and singing. I was the best singer and dancer you have ever seen. Sadly, now I'm sober, I realise that isn't true. That was, again, something in my head which I thought was true. I was a bit upset today when I saw the programme and it said, surprise, and I'm it. I'm the surprise. And I chaired a meeting earlier, and a fellow shared that he was really grateful to be here, and he was looking forward to the surprise tonight. And I felt really upset. And then I smiled and I thought, well, I know, but you're going to find out. I don't know where you are, but sorry, it's me. I came into AA 6 weeks before you. So I'm 6 weeks more advanced. So I'm out of nappies. I have the occasional mishap. Why did I come to AA? I didn't really know. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I was born in England, into a mad family, a mad English Catholic working class family. A dad who was an alcoholic, very violent, with my mother. My mother, this was the early 60s. Yeah, I know, I don't know how, but it was the early 60s, and it was a Catholic family. We went to church every Sunday, and we just went to church. And as a child, I went to a Catholic school, and I remember Wednesdays was, we used to pray in the hall. And in the olden days, the hall had a wooden floor. So I was about 5, I suppose, and all I can remember is kneeling on the wooden floor. And it used to hurt your knees. There was a man, I suppose he was a priest. He'd got a white robey thing on, I don't know. Catholic have priests, don't they? Yeah, so he was a priest. And he was very nice, and he used to talk about things, and I was a kid, I didn't listen. And my dad used to go around with the plate to collect the money, and I'm sure he nicked quite a lot of it. And then he'd go off to the pub, come home, batter my mother, and then this would continue. So I had this impression of this godly thing. It was a bad thing. And God was bad because he made my dad act really strangely. And I was the eldest in the family, and I'd got a brother a year younger. And we had quite a torrid time, and I was my brother's protector. From a very early age, I felt grown up and I behaved like a grown up. And I protected my brother. I looked after him. We were living with my mum and then my dad, and we went backwards and forwards. And this all had an effect on me at the time, I didn't know. And one day my dad said, let's go on holiday. And it was really exciting because my dad never did anything with us. Except he'd come home from the pub with the dog. So we had a dog. And then he brought a cat, and we had a cat. And then we had another dog. And he used to bring these animals, these pets, from the pub. And if you're a little kid, it's fun. But if you're a mum, it's no fun at all. But, you know, we sort of thought my dad was fun, me and my brother. And he suggested a holiday. And I thought, wow, going on. I know, I was a daddy's girl. I idolised my dad. And I knew something wasn't quite right, but that's all I knew. So he suggested, let's go on holiday, and it's a secret, don't tell mummy. So I thought that was strange. I said, well, isn't mummy coming too? Well, no, don't worry about that. So he picked us up for the weekend, and he took us away, me and my brother. We were in the car, and it was exciting. We went to a place in England called Wiltshire. And I'd never been there before, and I thought we were going to the seaside. Now, where I was wasn't a seaside. And my dad had decided that he wanted to take half his kids with him, so he kidnapped us. I couldn't believe it. I wanted to know where my mum was. And he said, oh, your mum doesn't want you. You know, your mum wants you to live with me. And I lived with the wicked aunt, his sister, for about 8 weeks, and I went to a new school. And that, for me, was the time where I decided that I was going to look after my brother on whatever these grown-ups in this world did. It wasn't going to affect me. So finally, my mum found out where we were, and we were hauled back to Warwickshire in the middle of England. And we had a normal-ish life. My mum remarried, and Danny became my stepdad. And he was a great bloke. He was a really lovely bloke, except he was a policeman. And that scared me, because he was a policeman. Because in those olden days, policemen, you were scared of policemen. So I was very good. I did everything I was supposed to do. I went through school, and I was quite good at school. I was one of these annoying people that thought they knew everything. So if the teacher asked a question, I'd always be there with my hand up. And even if she didn't, or he didn't ask a question, I was always got my hand up. So I used to talk a lot. I got on fine. I was really outgoing. I had friends, but I didn't really feel comfortable. I used to have a friend for a short while, and then I'd go on to another friend and another friend. I realise now I didn't let people get close to me. And, you know, that was just the way it was. And I hit 16, and I discovered pubs in England. Now, the drinking age was 18, but, you know, 2 years before you're supposed to, that was what my friends were doing. So I'd go to the pub, and I'd wear really high platform heels to look taller and look older. And I get served in pubs. And I didn't have very much money. I used to do a paper round, and I babysit. And I used to buy martini and lemonade. And it's a white liquid, and you put lemonade with it. And it's like pop. It's very fizzy and sweet. But the reason I did that, because in the pub, it was a young people's pub. If the barman saw your glass was empty, they'd throw you out, so I'd be able to buy maybe 3 drinks in an evening. Then I'd go to the toilet, fill it up with tap water so I could stay in the pub. And my drinking then was, yeah, it wasn't very, well, it was very good. I was very good at it. I managed to get drunk every time I went out on 3 martinis. But then I would be, we used to call them in those days a surfer. So I'd surf the pub, see a glass and drink it, knock it back and put it down. And I used to get drunk. I honestly can't remember a time I went out and didn't end up very, very drunk. And it was fun, and all my friends were doing it, and it was a good laugh. My friends stopped doing it. They got into relationships, they had children, they became responsible. I got into relationships, I had children, and I didn't become responsible. I kept drinking. But I didn't, I had stretches when I didn't drink. I had three children, three boys. I didn't drink through my pregnancy because I knew that that wasn't a good thing to do. And I didn't really have a problem with that. But when the first two boys, when they got a little bit older, I had a Dutch parlour for 10 years, and it wasn't really a democracy at home. What I said went, and that's the way it was. I was just in charge, and he hadn't heard of Al-Anon, and he still hasn't. And I used to say I was very controlling, and he came from an alcoholic family, and he was quite happy to do as I said. And we had 10 years together with two children, and I was unhappy. And one day we were sitting on the couch, and I said, guess what? You can move out. And he moved out. And that's the way I would treat people. I didn't say to him, I'm unhappy, maybe we should discuss it, get some help. No, I decided I knew what I wanted, and that's what happened. So I was on my own for 2 years, and my two children used to go and spend every third weekend, I think, with Daddy. And that was party time. I don't know, how old would I have been? Probably late 30s, and it was fabulous. I could go out, I could party, I would go out until 5 o'clock in the morning, I'd go home, I'd sleep all day, and I thought, you know, this is fun. And I managed to find people to do it with me, and they were much younger than me, and they didn't have children. And I still couldn't be responsible. When my kids came back, I found that I was thinking, oh, I fancy a glass of wine. And I started buying drink at home. And that went fine for a while. I met my partner, my second partner, who I call now my present partner, to keep him on his toes. And we've been together now for 20 plus years. We've had a son together, who is 16, and he's getting just into that nice age of discovering alcohol, discovering girls. And we had a drinking relationship together. We were drinking buddies. We had great times. I was responsible some of the time. And then the last couple of years before I was stopped drinking, I became a home drinker behind the curtains. And that is when there was no fun at all. I went to work. I got promoted because I was such a good person. I got promoted to, it makes me laugh now, to team leader. Yeah? And you need to be selfless and you need to care about people. I don't know how I got that job because I wasn't interested in anybody except me. I don't know, maybe my boss was an alcoholic, that's right, I don't know, I really don't know. And I started drinking at the weekend. And I said to myself, I'm only going to drink from 2 in the afternoon. So that was my I put my limit. Do not start before 2 in the afternoon. And that lasted a little while. I'm not quite sure how long. But then it was Saturday, and I think my football team were playing at midday, so I could have a drink earlier because it was a special occasion. And this is the way it continued. And I started, I never drank in the morning before I went to work. That is what alcoholics do. And I wasn't, I really, really didn't think I was one because I was never going to turn out like my dad. And then I started to plan the drinking, and the planning of the drinking used to drive me mad. Because my partner had said to me, I think you're drinking too much. And I said, I think you should mind your own business. My drinking is my business. Your drinking is your business. So he used to drink with me. I think we'd share a bottle of wine during dinner, because I was a pretty posh drinker. I didn't just drink beer, and I didn't drink cider. I certainly would never drink cider. I drank good quality red wine, and with fish, I drank white wine. So that was, again, that told me that I wasn't alcoholic, because that's not what alcoholics do. And we'd have this bottle of wine on the table, and he'd go into the kitchen, because he was the one that did the cooking. He'd go into the kitchen, and I'd pour a glass. And I can always remember, I'd knock it back, and then put more in mine. You know, does he not see from the bottle that it's missing? I just didn't know. I didn't think of that. And this is the way it went. And he often worked in the evening, and I'd come home from work, and I had a really important decision to make. How was I going to get my alcohol in the house without him knowing? And I would spend from about 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock planning my little scheme. And I had different choices. I could either buy it on my way home, stop off at Central Station, go to a shop, buy it, put it in my bag, but then the bottles clinked together. And it was quite heavy because I had to have at least 2. Or I could get home. He would leave and go on the tram at 5:50. There was a corner shop down my road that closed at 6. So I had time to run there, buy the wine and bring it back. But I was always worried he might come back before he got on the tram. And then where was I, you know? All this stuff used to go on in my head the whole time. And the drinking got worse. It just got worse and worse. But then I thought, well, I've had a hard life, you know. My life's been pretty shit, really. Wouldn't everybody drink? If the fact that I'm not in prison, that I'm not a rapist, I don't commit crimes, I don't do anything like that. So I've turned out pretty well, and I believe that. I thought I was a good mother, a good partner, a good daughter. And I wasn't. I was unaware of a lot of things that was going on. I used to put my kids to bed at night, and that's when I could crack the bottles open. And I used to leave them at home, and there was a shop that was one of these evening shops. And I think it was 8 minutes there and 8 minutes back. That's if I ran. And I'd be telling myself, that's it, the bottle's finished, I'm not going to the evening shop. And I just went, so I left my kids in bed unattended, just to get the alcohol. And that's how it was. And I was very, very unhappy. My kids were unhappy. My mum had gone to her GP and said, I think my daughter's got a drinking problem. And her GP said, well, that's your daughter's problem. And it was my problem, but I couldn't see it. So one day I had a good plan, and I decided I couldn't do it anymore. So Saturday afternoon I got rid of the kids, I got rid of my partner, and I decided to take alcohol and drugs. and I took them, and I can remember I phoned a friend and the ambulance came. They took me off to hospital and they wanted to pump my stomach, and I said, "You're not touching me," and I was really aggressive and horrible. And they said, "Okay, off you go home." And I remember sitting in the corner in this hospital room, and I said, "They can't send me home. I can't do it anymore. I need help." So they put me in a funny farm in Panossia. They put me in for 6 weeks, and they gave me a chat. They asked me loads of questions. And as far as I remember, they never once asked me if I drank. And I didn't tell them either. I didn't tell them. I wasn't going to tell them. I was there for 6 weeks. I had a ball. I loved it. There was no responsibility. I didn't have to go to work. And I think within the first 2 or 3 days, I palled up with a girl. And we used to sneak out. And we used to buy alcohol, drink it, and come back. And we had a whale of a time. And that's just the way it was. I needed help, but I wasn't really being honest. I wasn't going to tell them what I thought my problem was. So I came home, and I checked the computer out. I went online, and I looked up AA. And I did there's a test on there you can do. You can fill the questionnaire, that's all. You can fill in, ask you all these questions. And I did the questions. I'm like, "Oh, yeah, I got that one right." And I got that one right. I think there were 12, and I got 11 out of 12. The best test result ever. And I knew I had a problem. I knew before I did that. And I'd like to say I then went to AA. No, I didn't. I think it was about a year later. And it was coming up to, Easter, and I knew I had 2 weeks off work. And I knew exactly what those 2 weeks were going to do. I was going to get up, I was on holiday, I was going to start drinking. Go in, put the kettle on, reach in the fridge, drink a beer, hair of the dog. And I just couldn't do it anymore. I just could not face it. So I phoned the helpline in Amsterdam. And there was a lovely lady. And I said, I think I might have a problem with alcohol. And she said, "Okay." And I said, "I don't know what to do." And she suggested that I went to a meeting. She was very, very generous, and I wasn't capable of looking up the meetings and things, and she told me where the next meeting was, and she suggested I went. And this was a Wednesday, so the next day was a Thursday, and I was living in The Hague, and I went to a meeting. I drove to the car park, and it was in a hospital, and that wasn't very nice. So I sat in the car park, and the meeting started at 8 o'clock. And I sat there from 20 to 8, and I really didn't want to go in. I did eventually go in late, so I missed all the bit in the beginning when they say, "Do we have a newcomer?" Oh, yeah, if only I'd known. So I went in, I sat in the corner, and I just looked. I think I probably sat with my head down a lot of the time. And I saw the big book, and I thought, "Hell, it's a Bible." And people was talking, and I wasn't in a state of mind to be able to understand what they were saying. And the meeting ended, and I got up, and I went for that door. And somebody got in front of me and said, "Oh, are you here for the first time?" And I'm like, "Yeah." "Well, just keep coming back." And that was a person who I got to know quite well. And unfortunately, she's not with us anymore. She was a fellow who didn't make it. And that's part of my sobriety, that I think of her regularly. because I'll never forget. And then there was another lady who's sitting here, and she came and spoke to me, and it was another French one. And I had no clue. What, I don't know what she said, and I went home, and I was furious. Oh, I forgot two bits. Just before the end, they asked for money. It's sex, it's extortion. And then we hold hands. Not nice. And then they say a prayer. I don't know how I drove home and didn't crash. I was sober-ish. And I got home and I got my phone. And I phoned this woman from the AM who had very, very kindly given me her own personal number. And I told her what I thought of her. And I ranted and I raved at her. And I went on for, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 minutes. And I was just shouting at her and, what do you think you're doing? And that's not for me. And she let me go on and on. And then I stopped and she said, well, what are you going to do? It's not that funny. I'm being serious and sincere here. And I didn't have an answer. I didn't have an answer to this lady. And she said, why don't you try another meeting? And I did. I went on the Friday, which became my home group, at a Quaker house. And then I went, and I just kept going back to meetings. I didn't understand very much of it. But I knew if I was in a meeting, I wasn't drinking. So that was a bonus. And I used to go home, and I was exhausted. Emotionally, people... I remember at one meeting there's this guy and he was a bit all right. And he was huge, he had a leather jacket on. I don't know where he is now, he's not here tonight. And he was like a biker. And he sat there talking about his feelings. I was amazed. Absolutely amazed. I got home and I used to go to bed. Because I was just so drained. And also if I was in bed I wouldn't drink. So I went on like this for quite a few months. I went to lots of meetings and it was suggested I get a sponsor and it was explained to me. And I thought, well, that sounds like a good idea. I don't know what else to do. But my sponsor needs to be English. I'm not having an American twangy Dutch. She needs to be around my age. I'm not having some young dolly bird telling me what to do. And she needs to have children as well. That's quite hard in The Hague to get somebody with all those attributes that I wanted. So I sussed somebody out and then I didn't see her. Because she was at my home meeting and I didn't see her. And I asked around and they said, oh, she's broken her leg. I went, what? I wanted to speak to her. And I was so annoyed that she'd broken her leg. Because I was going to tell her she could be my sponsor. So I hung out there and she hobbled in and I sort of said, you could be my sponsor if you want. And she said, oh, I'd love to be your sponsor. And I thought, well, yeah, I'd love to be my sponsor. Because I thought I knew everything. And she took me through the program. And I started slowly to get it. Did I want to be there? No. It didn't feel, you know, sometimes people say, oh, I went to my first meeting. I felt like I was at home. No, I didn't. I didn't like it. I didn't like you sitting there. I didn't understand why somebody that was 20 years sober still came to meetings. I mean, loser. You know, get a life. And that's truly what I thought. And if only I'd realised. So I did. I got a sponsor and I worked my programme and I went to a convention when I was 3 months sober, and I cried through the whole weekend. And then I went to Ostend, I went to a convention there, and I was on my fourth step, and I spoke to some random person there, and I said, I don't want to do my fourth step, because that means I've got to do my fifth one with my sponsor, and I don't want to do it. And he said, well, if you don't want to do it with your sponsor, get a new sponsor. And I thought, oh. I wanted him to tell me, come on, you'll be all right. I wanted the sympathy. And that's what I did. I didn't feel comfortable with my sponsor at that time. So I had somebody, I sussed somebody out, and I wanted what she had. Was she English? No. She was older than me. That's always good. But she didn't have kids. But it didn't matter. And I felt that change was just what I needed. And we work from there. And it was the first time in my life that I felt equal to someone. I didn't think I had to pretend. I didn't need to impress. I could just be honest and say what I thought, knowing that there would be no judgment. Am I boring you? I'll finish now. If you try and leave, I can embarrass you. And that's what I did. I worked with my sponsor, and things just happened. Things that I couldn't understand and things that weren't clear, they just became clear. And I must have said so many times, oh yeah. And I thought, why can't I see things like that? Why don't I understand? And I know now that I wasn't given the skills and the tools of life. And I don't blame anybody. I've made amends to my dad and to my mum, and that was an incredible experience that has made me a better person. And I feel that I'm working towards the person I was supposed to be. And I'm going towards that light. I sometimes stand still, but I know I've got a path, and the only reason that I've got this path is because of the program. And it's given me so much, and I don't want my old life back. And I know I can have it if I pick up a drink, because I am sure one is not going to be enough. One glass, one bottle, maybe one case to start with, but it's never going to be enough. And what's happened for me is I've discovered so many things about myself that I didn't know. Some of them not great, but some of them are really good. And I know that my higher power that has always been there with me is guiding me. And I'm never on my own. I always felt quite lonely. And I'm never, ever on my own. My higher power, if I allow him in, will show me the way. And the program has my two sons that left home because of my drinking. They now come back and see me regularly. I have one of the most incredible things. I have two granddaughters, and they've never seen me drunk. They have never seen their grandma. I mean, isn't that awful to think, a grandma drunk? You know, they've never seen that. And they love my eldest granddaughter, Sophie's too. And she gets so excited because when she comes, I do stupid things. But it's not with alcohol. You know, we make Play-Doh. I become the queen Play-Doh maker. We do rolling in the garden. We catch frogs. All these things. And they make me happy. If that makes me sad, I'm not sure. But it is stuff that... it's incredible. And for people that have not been in the program long, if I can do it, there is... I needed it, and there's a lot of people that needed it, but I wanted it so much. And if I can do it, there's no reason why anybody in the whole world can't do it. That is how I feel. And is it easy? No, sometimes it's not. But it's a lot. It's so much. I feel so much better the life I have now than the way it used to be. And life, I read a book. And what is it? Life is difficult. The first sentence of the book. And I carried on through the book. I knew I shouldn't have. But I, sponsor made me. and life is difficult. But I'm not a drama queen anymore. And it doesn't, I don't react. And I don't drink over it. And for me that is a precious, precious gift that I will ever, ever be given. And I plan on with my higher power. Continue the path I'm on, and I highly recommend it. And that's it from me. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 to $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.